This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, so much for the recent upbeat change in the stock market sentiment. That two-day equity rallies we just talked about here in the United States with Abigail really coming to an end, although we're definitely off our lows of the session, thanks to hot economic data pouring cold water on investor thinking that the global monetary tightening cycle was close to peaking. And we did feel like pigpiling on that thinking was the president of the San Francisco Fed, Mary Daly, who stopped by Bloomberg headquarters. She caught up with our own Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent, Michael McKee, who joins us here in our Interactive Broker studio. And so we are all talking pivot. And yet.
Well, we had to ask her about pivot because that's what's the main topic in the markets. It's interesting because we've seen markets get very schizophrenic about this. One week they think the Fed is going to cut back. Just last week, the Fed was not going to cut rates at all.
Right.
Now you've got a rate cut priced in starting in March. And I asked Mary Daly about that, and the graph you can see on the WIRP function, the bar chart that shows these rate cuts, and she said, not going to happen.
Well, she's one of these classic data-dependent Fed non-voting member this year. But she's basically saying, look at core inflation. It's pointing the wrong way. We're accelerating July to August, and we'll get September a later date. That's her point, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Here's what she said.
I don't see that happening at all. I see us as raising to a level that we believe is restrictive enough to bring inflation down and then holding it there until we see inflation truly get close to 2% and demonstrate that price stability is restored.
So basically, Mary Daly, president of the San Francisco Fed. So basically, stop it, right, everybody?
Yeah. Knock it off.
You've actually been warning us. Every time we've said it, you're like, no, there's no pivot.
Yeah, there's no pivot. And I asked her, if we debate constantly 50-75, 50-75, yeah, for what they're going to do at the next meeting. And I asked her about that, and she said it's not how much we do at each meeting. It's where we get to and then how long it stays there. She wants the terminal Fed funds rate, she thinks, is going to be somewhere between 4.5% and 5%, and that they're going to try to get to 4% by the end of this year, and then they leave it there until they see significant progress. If inflation should collapse, then maybe we do get a pivot.
She talks about being nimble, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, nimble, but resolute with the word. And she said, you know, people, I go out to Boise, Idaho, and people don't know what I mean by that. And she said, we are focused on bringing inflation down. That is what we're going to do. But how we do it, we can be nimble and we can react. If there's some issue in the economy, we don't have to raise rates as fast, or we don't have to raise rates that month or whatever. It's just going to be a question of keeping an eye on the economy, but also keeping your eye on the main goal, which is bringing down inflation.
So we know you had to ask about the pivot because of the rally right. that we've seen, certainly in the equity markets. But what was top of mind for you, Mike, who follows this day in and day out?
Well, I think that was the biggest idea that she communicated, the idea that, no, we're not watching the markets for signals for what we're going to do. We're watching inflation. She said basically what the Fed wants to see, and this is something to keep in mind for Friday, is the economy moderating, that we see jobs, job gains start to slow down, and we see inflation, particularly core inflation, start to slow down. It doesn't go away immediately, but you see a process underway. And then they'll know they're doing the right thing, and then they can sort of stop where they are and leave it where they are until they see there's enough restraint on the economy to get this inflation problem out of the way.
So today's economic data, how does that play into the thought?
Goes against the idea that she was talking about, the ISM services numbers today. But she did point out the JOLTS numbers yesterday. She said she's been talking to corporations all over the West. She has a big district. And they've been saying that they are cutting back on their hiring. And in many cases, and Ed, you know this better than anybody, the tech companies are just they're not going to hire anymore this year. They're done. And some of them are actually talking about some layoffs. She said what happens is the companies go to these online firms with post resumes and job openings, and they sign a 3-month contract. And they don't say, all right, call the firm up and cancel the contract a month early. They just let it run out, which is why job postings have remained high. And she said she thinks they've been telling her for months that this is going to happen. She thinks that's what we saw in yesterday's data, that the companies are seriously starting to slow down on their hiring. And concomitantly, she said, don't look at jobless claims, because that's the last thing that's going to happen in this economy. There's still so many openings that nobody's talking about layoffs. They're just talking about not hiring.
You've been very kind over the years to take me to meet Mary Daly, and she's one of these sort of Fed in action type figures. She goes out into the real world, and she seems to be saying here, we recognize the pain of everyday Americans, but they also need to know that the Fed is, as you said, resolute in fighting inflation, not necessarily listening to their pain in how they decide to take action.
She talks about going to a Walmart in the San Francisco Bay Area, just dressed in a sweatshirt and jeans. She told them she was an economist, but she didn't tell them who she was. And she walked around interviewing customers. And they all said they're much more worried about inflation than they are about jobs.
More worried about inflation rather than jobs. All right, great reporting as always and a great interview. Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee on Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We mentioned those headlines that the judge in the Elon Musk Twitter trial saying she hasn't received any filing yet to halt the case. And that says that October 17th trial is still on for now. So I feel like, Ed Ludlow, you've been covering this story. You're here, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, also in our studio. It's a story that keeps on giving. Just when we think we're getting to an end.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe not.
As it stands, I'm still off to Delaware. But what I would say is language is important, right? So Musk said, you know what? I will buy Twitter for $54.20 a share. Did Twitter say? Twitter said, we're committed to closing the deal at $54.20 a share. Nowhere did they say, we accept your reoffer, Mr. Musk. You know, so we've been waiting to see what they'll do, whether they drop proceedings against him. And now we know they are yet to do so.
All right. We also want to bring in, we mentioned Joel Weber is with us, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. So too is Bloomberg's Sarah Friar, who's writing about Elon's turnabout as well. She's Bloomberg News Big Tech team leader, author of No Filter, the inside story of Instagram. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. But Joel, I mean, if you had to put this story to bed, what would you do right now for the cover? cover.
You call Sarah and say, hey, what's going on? There's a piece of art that we commissioned to go with Sarah's story that is the art of the moment. It's a Tesla covered in bird poop. It's awesome and it's perfect. And my headline for it is Twitter's turn. I think this is also what Sarah ultimately writes here is for a while, it's been sort of like, who's actually in charge right here? Who got the high ground? And I think what this shows is that Twitter now officially has the high ground. So Sarah, talk to us about how you expressed that idea.
Well, I think that what Elon Musk is offering here is what he's already offered. He's already said that he would buy the company for $44 billion. This doesn't give Twitter anything that they didn't already have, so they have no reason to take him at his word, because let's look at how his word has happened, how it's resulted in prior occasions, right? He said he would join Twitter's board, and then he reneged on that shortly thereafter when he got in an argument, and then he said he would buy the company, and then a couple weeks later he said he wouldn't. So I think that Twitter really has no reason to trust him, and I don't see a scenario where they are going to just take this new offer and call it a day. I think that they're going to be really careful and if they're wise, then keep the lawyers involved.
So the alternative headline doesn't go quite as well with the image that I proposed, but show me the money.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's really the ticket here. I mean, we know that the funding is in place. We know that everything is as it should be to close the deal. Nothing has really changed on that front. What has changed is it's been a particularly embarrassing few weeks for Elon Musk. His private text messages have become public.
I've been dying to do just a table read of all of those text messages, Sarah, right. Just for like go through them all. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh my goodness, there's so many gems. But yeah, I think there's that. But he is. I talked to a lawyer today who said the most cynical view of this move from Elon Musk is that he is maybe trying to pressure Twitter publicly into dropping the suit, and then he might still not buy Twitter, right. And it might find another reason to.
It's
drop
like
out
one of these
this.
Stories, Joel, where you're like, this cannot get any more weird, and you walk into work on a Tuesday, and suddenly it gets more weird. But it's Sarah's point. We learned a lot from the discovery process, the text messages. You wonder what we didn't learn. And this is part of our Bloomberg reporting. What would we have found if that deposition goes ahead and then it's filed as evidence, Joel, later in the week, perhaps, if a trial happens?
Yeah, perhaps you'd like to go to Delaware for us and find out.
Well, as it stands, as I say, I am going to Delaware. But.
Wait, I mean, and look, like this is why it's like the best business story of the year. I mean, you think about where this started. I mean, think about, and you know, Matt Levine wrote this in his newsletter today, money stuff, that, you know, if just from a money standpoint, like Morgan Stanley, this does not look good for Morgan Stanley. When all this was proposed, it all sounded great. And like, we are in a completely different economic environment now.
In terms of the financing, right?
Yeah,
financing.
We're talking about the debt here, right? Yep. That Musk lined up as part of his funding for the deal.
And so I think the conversation is and how much bashing, you know, Twitter has endured here. And you know, ultimately, Sarah, I thought the most interesting thing that you had in the remarks ultimately is this scene that you culminate with, which is this conversation that's happening at Twitter when this news happens, right? What, take us there.
So at Twitter, my colleague Kurt Wagner has many sources of the company, and he found that they were listening, of all things, to presentations from teams on their 2023 plan, which, if this deal goes through, it's a total waste of time, because Elon Musk has very different ideas about how to run Twitter. And what was interesting was, you know, nobody really stopped to acknowledge that this news had just gone by. And I think that this is just a company that's used to being in limbo. They're always finding themselves at the center of some drama or another. They've had activists on their board. They've shuffled through leaders. They've been in acquisition flirtations in the past. So I think that these employees, they're also they can complain on Slack or make memes of the situation. But I do think that these really big decisions are probably going to wait until we actually know where Elon Musk is going to own this company.
Yeah, I was told by a source, Sarah, as you know, that in the first 15 minutes of that meeting, Parag Agrawal, the CEO of Twitter, made a presentation and then disappeared from the meeting. And for 2 or 3 hours, employees sat there while the news was breaking all around them and nothing. You know, there was silence.
Amazing.
You know, Sarah, what happens next very quickly?
Well, I think we have to see how Twitter responds. The two sides are talking today. Whether an agreement will come out of that, we might hear today. We might not. The judge has said she has not received a filing for a request to stay the case. So that means that things are not all settled. We still have some Twitter clearly still has some discussions right. They need to have to be to their satisfaction.
It's like an episode of Billions.
Oh, I mean, let's have our own show about this.
We're way past the far-fetchedness of Billions, guys.
But my most favorite thing here is Delaware.
Yeah.
Delaware. All right, Sarah Friar, thank you so much as always. Big tech team leader, Bloomberg News, also author of No Filter, the Inside Story of Instagram. These are the remarks this week?
Remarks, indeed.
All right. In
Twitter's
the
turn.
Upcoming issue of the magazine, of course, that was the voice of the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. On Bloomberg Radio.
As we've talked about, I just got to pull up actually Twitter because with the market turnaround, I just want to see what Twitter's doing. Still down about 1% because there's still some uncertainty whether or not Elon Musk will cross the finish line when it comes to buying the company. Meantime, I love this. Elon, I feel like Ed is flashing that new shiny thing, which he is good about doing. And it's called what? X, the everything app?
Yeah. I mean, we always talk about this in the context of Tesla, right? That one of his skills is keeping everyone looking to the horizon.
Look over here.
Forget what's happening right now. You know, here's
look
what
away. Look away from the fire.
Honestly, X, what is X? I don't know. Do you know? Does our next guest know? I guess we should find out.
All right, Tom Giles, come on in. Executive editor of Bloomberg Technology. He's with us from our San Francisco bureau. All right, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
So great to have you here, the three of us. Fun conversation. So what is X?
Well, based on yesterday's tweet, he's calling it X the Everything app. It makes me think of the Everything store, right, that Amazon wants to provide all of these services and sell all of these items to everybody in around the world. What he's talking about, what he's alluding to, is some kind of a super app. It's a one-stop shop where you can go and do much more than what you can do on Twitter now. It's already a very useful tool for those of us who are big Twitter users.
No, we all tweet every single day, all of us,
right?
All three of us.
You know, what we're up to, stuff we're reporting on. But he wants to make it more useful. One of his complaints, and he has many complaints about Twitter, is that he wants it to be more useful to people. And what he's alluding to is the way that companies like Tencent in China have used WeChat and turned it into something called a super app. That's something, like I said, a one-stop shop where you can go and do much more than communicate. You can You know, you can have your DMs with folks. You can have group chats. But you can also do things like book cars. So it plays the role of an Uber. Or you can use it to order in food. So it's your Grubhub. You can use it for a whole host of services. And this is something that has taken off in parts of Asia and certainly gained a lot of popularity in China, where Tencent is, where WeChat is everywhere. And he would certainly he'd certainly love to have Twitter have that same kind of usefulness.
Well, I mean, to me, this is logical, because I believe I'm right in saying Musk said he wanted to grow Twitter's user base from around 235 million now to a billion. And you wonder, how's he going to get there? Right. I mean, we use Twitter actively. Much of the press does and the media. But you wonder who the new audience for Twitter will be. I mean, what other concrete proposals do we have from Musk, Tom?
Well, he's compared it to TikTok and wanting there to be more functionality in terms of the stuff that you share on the blogging service. Right now, Twitter is still very much a tool that we use for short tweets that are, you know, full of our words. And sometimes there's images and sometimes there's video, but it's not a big video sharing site. You know, but there's a lot of things. I mean, remember where Elon Musk got his start, which was in payments, which is in, you know, revolutionizing mm-hmm. the way people send and receive money. So imagine, if you will, if he has his way and if he, you know, can unleash his engineers and get them to, you know, make the products that would make it more effective. Think about what if Twitter was more of like a payments company where you could use it to, you know, to carry out transactions in the way that we currently use Venmo or PayPal or some of these other services. What if you could do other, you know, carry out other financial transactions with it? You know, and I mean, the other thing that people, you know, Tencent is also a big entertainment purveyor of entertainment. We don't think of Twitter as being a platform for that kind of thing.
Yes.
We think of that more, you know, that's more YouTube and to some degree even Facebook. But and obviously, you know, Apple and some of the other sellers of devices that we have. The problem that I have with this concept of a super app is, while it has taken off in parts of Asia, in the United States, we've become really, really accustomed to having a whole slew of apps on our phones. We're very comfortable with it. I find it kind of clunky, and I'd love the idea of something more like a super app. The problem is we're really entrenched, and we've really become accustomed to having, yeah, you know, 100 apps on our phone and just, you know, scrolling right and left to get from app to app. We've grown accustomed to it, even though it's clunky, even though it's inconvenient. If he can revolutionize that, it would certainly be a sea change in the way at least people here in the United States use our smartphones.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'd love to have like some streamlining. I have so many apps, but I do wonder, like, how do you move from where we are today to kind of an aggregator to almost, yeah, to some extent where it's one-stop shopping. Great stuff. Tom Giles, thank you so much. We always appreciate when you can find time for us. He's Bloomberg Technology Executive Editor, joining us from our San Francisco Bureau. But I do kind of am blown away again by Elon and his ability, right, to get us to be having a conversation about something else.
You know, Tom leads our coverage of tech. He leads the team, and we're already looking to the what next. We're not really, yeah, sure what now. You know, those headlines that the trial's still going ahead October 17th.
We're not done yet.
We're not done yet.
I really want to know about that white robot, that humanoid.
Let's stick on topic.
The human in the bodysuit. Oh my gosh. Can't make this stuff up. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it, everybody. Just about a little under 10 minutes left in today's trading session. You heard Charlie break down the numbers. We're just off our highs. We're seeing a little bit of selling in the last few minutes, but we are definitely off our lows of the session. Call it, for the most part, unchanged, but slightly lower when it comes to those major equity averages. So let's get to the drive to the close. Aaron Kennan is back. He's co-founder and chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management, roughly over $1 billion in assets under management, on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Aaron, good to have you here. Ed Ludlow is in for Tim on this Wednesday. Let's talk about the markets. Do you feel like we are seeing a market capitulation at this point, that maybe we've bottomed out when it comes to equities?
Well, I certainly hope so, Carol and Ed, yeah. But I fear that that may not be the case when, you know, we sort of look at the historic analog of what tends to happen when markets find bottoms in bear markets. And usually that means the Fed has stopped tightening and they are actually starting to reduce their Fed funds rate. It usually means that the interest rate curve is positive and nicely positive, and usually there's some sort of panic embedded in the market where valuations cut through sort of longer-term averages, and we haven't really seen that. We've seen a correction in valuations, but we haven't sliced through those averages. So somewhat cautious there, and on the bond side, you know, probably a little more just incrementally constructive. You know, when you look at the inflation adjusted rates of return, real rates are positive by about 150 basis points now. And mm-hmm. if we're sitting here on December 31st, yes. they were negative by about 110 basis points. And so there's certainly more cushion, and there is an alternative on the margin to equities, at least here in the short term.
Yeah, looking at the yield on the 10-year pushing up by around 12 basis points is following kind of a push higher in yields in Europe earlier. Hey, Aaron, for you, how much of this is a story of good data, bad news in the context of the Fed? We've kind of been talking about this all day on Bloomberg Radio and television.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, day to day, earlier this week, that certainly seemed to play out, where we had the JOLTS data suggesting that maybe there was some softening in the employment side of the docket, and then we saw the equity market surge, and the dollar was weakening too over the last couple of days, which certainly was a tailwind to, I think, the equity and risk on trade. But, you know, today's a little different. Yet ISM services that were stronger than expected, and the market's unchanged, and bonds are actually selling off in price, higher in yield. So, but I do think the longer term trend is what you're alluding to, which is the Fed is looking for evidence that the employment picture is indeed softening and that there's a trend line to it. We'll see, of course, payrolls on Friday. But they're also looking for the economic data to play through, and that's been very mixed. We saw ISM manufacturing earlier this week, which was weaker than anticipated, and then, of course, the services number today was stronger. So, you know, we'll have to see. They're certainly, you know, caught between a bit of a rock and a hard place, and they know their reputation's on the line. They probably entered the game of raising rates a little too late, and they certainly do not want to be accused of pulling the ripcord on their tightening exercise too early.
So does that mean we're in a recession, we'll be in a recession, or I don't know, how do you see that side of the conversation?
Well, we do debate that question. We have had two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, so, you know, that tends to be the definition. Some refer to that as a technical recession, and others consider it an unofficial one. We'll have to see what the NBER says later on that front. But what I do think, you know, we need to be thinking about is, you know, where is the trend for earnings? We haven't seen earnings roll over yet. There's an anticipation that that's going to occur in the quarters ahead. And how will the markets react to that? And will they get ahead of it? Is this going to be a shallow recession or a deep recession? And, you know, certainly there are lots of sort of varying opinions around that particular point.
Hey, guys, just a kind of public service announcement. The NASDAQ 100 just ticking into the red, down 0.2%, joining other major indices. That was a pretty short-lived late rally in the session with about 5 minutes left to go in trading. It's interesting, is recession priced in? You know, we've kind of seen earnings expectations and equities come down, Aaron, but in a recession, typically you reprice expectations, right? 10 to 20%. And it doesn't feel like we actually have that full recession pricing, particularly in the technology sector, but other corners of the equities market.
Yeah, I think a very shallow recession, I would argue, is probably priced in. But if we are seeing some sort of double-digit decline in, let's say, S&P 500 earnings next year, that's probably not yet priced into the markets. And so, you know, we'll have to see how that trend plays out. Certainly, there are headwinds to the strong dollar. It was nice to see earlier this week the dollar weaken, which I think is providing a bit of an airbag for the equity market here. But there's a lot of uncertainty outside the United States, which can, on the margin, keep the dollar stronger, even if our economic data is deteriorating.
So where do you commit new money, which is a question I like to ask everybody. And I'm curious, yeah. You know, Aaron, is new money coming in?
Well, yes, and also on the first question, and you know, whenever there's uncertainty, there's concern, and whenever there's concern, there are people that may feel as though they need better advice or they haven't had professional advice before. So we're in the business of providing that to clients and creating, you know, risk-adjusted asset allocations and providing advice across their financial life, whether it's an individual, family, or a non-for-profit organization. So for us, we're not heavily tactical, but if we are not at target on certain asset classes, we will make adjustments. I think at this moment where interest rates are, making adjustments, extending duration on the margin within fixed income makes sense. You can buy an investment-grade portfolio that matures at the end of 2024 with a yield to maturity of almost 5% right now, mm-hmm. and that has an average maturity of less than 2 years. You can buy something similar that matures at the end of 2023 with a yield to maturity of 4.70 and has an average maturity of less than 1 year. You know, you had 2 year treasury yields at the beginning of this year at 20 basis points. Now we're at 4.15.
Yeah.
So we think the 60-40 portfolio makes a lot more sense going forward here than it did at the beginning of the year. And so, you know, on the margin, on a risk-adjusted basis, we think if you're underweight your fixed income exposure,
right.
may want to wake up and reallocate on the margin. Also, mortgage-backed securities, Fannie and Freddie mortgages, you can buy them through an ETF or individually. Those are quite attractive, trading below par
right
now with a 5.5% coupon.
Yep.
Interesting, compelling risk-adjusted return opportunity there, in our opinion.
As you said earlier, there's an alternative to stocks at this point because of the move up that we've seen in various fixed income and yields in particular. Aaron Kennan, co-founder and CEO at Clear Harbor Asset Management, joining us on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.